Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now convened.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC14-1300, State versus Gallagher. Arguing for the petitioner, Cynthia Kagiwata. Arguing for the respondent, Peter Hanano. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Ms. Kagiwata and Mr. Hanano. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. Ms. Kagiwata will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go for your argument, so you can save that time for rebuttal. Mr. Hanano will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Cynthia Kagiwata, and I'm representing petitioner, defendant, appellant, John Leslie Gallagher. There's one issue before the court today, and that's whether the ICA made a grave error of law and or fact in affirming the circuit court's ruling on a Hawaii Rule 403 matter, and specifically whether or not the introduction of four prior incidents in this case, whether the minimal probative value of those four prior instances were outweighed by unfair prejudice. And just as a reminder to the court, Mr. Gallagher was charged with property damage in the second degree. He went to trial, and at trial there were two videos shown which showed him going to the complainants, in this case the Normans, going to their house and kicking their vehicle repeatedly. Mr. Gallagher testified himself at trial, and he admitted that he kicked the vehicle. So the only issue really at trial was whether or not he intended to do the $1,500 damages that would elevate it to property damage too. Over defense objection, one of the main complaining witnesses, Mrs. Norman, testified at length about 6 months of prior incidents of harassment that Mr. Gallagher engaged in leading up to this event. And indeed, this was, I think, the theme of the prosecutor's case, because from the opening statement through the testimony and through closing, the prosecutor relied heavily on this being a series of escalating events. And so the problem here is, from the very get-go, the prosecutor set out to confuse the jury and focus on the harassment that Mr. Gallagher engaged into the Normans instead of what was really at issue, which was property damage. And this is a very unusual case, because I know this is a very high standard to meet, the abuse of discretion standard. But in this particular instance, what makes it so unusual is that there were two videos of the entire incident. And those two videos made it unnecessary to bring in any prior incidents. Those videos were alternative proof of Mr. Gallagher's intent and whether or not he did indeed intend to do $1,500 worth of damage.
Well, what about the trial court's observation that these prior incidents were necessary to provide context so that the jury would understand how such a thing could happen and that he might have had the intent to cause a significant amount of damage, as opposed to if the jury just heard that he simply showed up that night out of nowhere?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the elements of property damage, there are no need to provide what happened in advance.
You know, all offenses, you usually don't need to show motive as an offense either, as an element, right?
Right.
But the prosecution usually is allowed to bring in motive, so just because it's not an element doesn't mean that it's not admissible.
Right. But even so, even if you accept that it was necessary to show some kind of context or whatever, there was this video which made the need for this other evidence minimal at best. And I think the problem, too, is the substantial unfair prejudice to Mr. Gallagher far outweighed any minimal probative value from these four prior incidents.
Ms. Kagiwata, while you're on the issue of the videos, let's assume it was an abuse of discretion, that it was error, and that it was overly prejudicial in the sense of the balancing under 403. Nonetheless, if you have the video, how is it that you contend that the error is harmless? Because, you know, one might suggest that videos are pretty strong evidence.
Right, but the problem being is that the jury kind of got distracted by all this the instances of the prior escalating events of these four incidents of harassment. And, you know, one of the factors in determining whether or not the prejudice outweighed the probative value is whether or not it was rousing the jury to overmastering hostility against the defendant and trying to elicit an emotional response. I would also note that the jury, during deliberations, sent out a question asking whether or not Mr. Foster was on his medications. And so I believe the goal of the prosecutor to try to show context kind of really didn't work anyhow.
And I thought the jury also asked about a restraining order or something like that. Was there some reference to that?
I don't recall that. I know that the prosecutor at one point tried to introduce evidence of a protective order.
Now, there was, as Justice McKenna indicates. One of the questions that, because the court did juror questioning, and there were several problematic questions. Was this the first time the defendant caused property damage against the Normans? Was the restraining order against Mr. Gallagher put in place by the Normans prior to this alleged damage? Was the defendant on medication during the time immediately preceding and during the truck-kicking incident? Was he skipping his meds? I mean, it's by allowing these incidents, it seems to have allowed the jury to consider all kinds of other matters.
Well, and that's the problem, as Your Honor has pointed out, I think it confused the jury as to what the issue was before them. You know, they were speculating about all kinds of things, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the specific questions. I would have to refresh my memory with the record. I do remember the one about the medication, though. And I think the problem is the jury was arguably confused about what they were being called upon to decide.
Well, this is a question of valuation, as you keep, repeating. I mean, legitimately so, in your brief. If it's just a question of valuation, how does overmastering hostility enter into which, how much damage was done to the van?
Well, what I don't understand is how does the court's reasoning that these prior incidents showed how much damage was done to the van, that doesn't seem to really match up either, especially since you had two experts who testified about the actual valuation of the damage.
Don't you have to show intent to do that certain amount of damage?
Right, but I believe that because there was alternative proof in the form of these two videos, which showed him kicking the vehicle repeated times.
But don't you have to intend to do a certain amount of damage?
Right, but I believe that could be determined from the alternative proof.
But he said that he didn't intend to do that amount of damage, despite what he was
right.
in the video, right?
But it was a question.
So it's a question for the jury.
Right, it's a question for the jury upon viewing these videos. You know, they could see that he was kicking the car, the vehicle.
There was considerable disparity. One expert said, I think it was 4583. One expert said 3,000, and the defendant testified 400. So you had three very different estimates about the damages. So clearly, would it appear that if, in fact, there was this hostility that you were contend occurred because of the priors, it could affect how the jury determined whether or not the defendant was aware of the amount of damage.
Yes, but because the two experts both testified to amounts that were over 1,500, that would have been sufficient.
Is it your position that no evidence regarding any prior negative contact between your client and the complaining witnesses should have been admitted?
Yes.
None whatsoever.
Yes.
It should have been but you're arguing 403. You're not arguing 404B. You're not arguing that none of it should have come in.
Well, in the CERT app, I did not argue that the evidence was completely irrelevant because I do believe there's some minimal probative value as the court has.
So you would concede that some 404B type evidence might be relevant as to the intent issue.
Right, but the problem I think is that it's minimal at best.
Okay, so what do you think should have been admitted and what do you think should have been excluded?
I still believe that none of it should have been admitted because it tended to confuse the jury, as can be seen by the jurors' questions. They didn't understand what they were being asked to decide. They were speculating about all kinds of things rather than focusing on whether or not he intended to do $1,500 damage to the vehicle.
You don't think that the CWs could have testified, you know, we've had some history, we've had some prior negative experiences with Mr. Gallagher or something along those lines?
I think it would have been difficult because, again, then you're starting to go down that path. And the videos were the strongest evidence that, you know, this was his intent to do this kind of damage. I think it starts to pull it away from, is this case about property damage or is it about harassment? And
wait,
again, that was...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. If the... Following your argument, if it's all in the video and the two experts testified that it was over $1,500, I don't understand what you're contesting if the jury found that it was over $1,500.
Well, Mr. Gallagher had a dispute as to whether or not the experts were correct on the amount of damage.
And that's your own expert, right? Wasn't one of them your expert? Or the defendant's expert?
No. Oh, they were both prosecution experts.
To prove this offense, not only does the damage amount have to be proven, but the defendant has to be aware of the amount of damage being proved. So that is also a factor in determining whether or not this was harmless or not.
Right. The probative value of all these harassment issues was minimal at best on his awareness to do $1,500 worth of damage that night.
Okay, you say that the other evidence isn't necessary because of the videos.
Correct.
What about the videos evidences his awareness of the amount of damages?
Well, as the prosecutor even argued, it showed him showing up very angry, very hostile, and kicking the vehicle multiple times. And so based on, this is a very rare case where you have an actual visual of the incident of property damage. Usually, you know, we're depending upon witnesses' description of what happened. And so here the jury could see for themselves, you know, what his level of hostility was, how many times he kicked the vehicle, you know, what his intent was based on his demeanor and his approach. And I think the problem, again, is by focusing so much on all these priors, it drew the jury's attention away from the property damage issue. And really, this case became about an escalating series of events against the Normans. And again, the prosecutor from beginning to end, that's what they argued, is this is an escalating series of events, a six-month odyssey that these poor people had to endure.
But absent some explanation of why this occurred, wouldn't the jury possibly get confused in that direction and begin asking questions of, well, how could this happen? How could he have intended such a thing? What history might there be?
But
that's what the judge is in the difficult place of having to weigh those factors and then making a call, and you know that's why we reviewed for abuse of discretion, because the trial judge is there on the ground trying to weigh these different factors and decide what's fair and apply the rule correctly.
Right, and I recognize it's a very difficult standard, the abuse of discretion standard, to overcome. But again, in this instance, even though they had these supposed incidents of context, the jury was completely confused. You know, they were asking all kinds of questions, so it didn't help to, you know, I think the problem is whether you had the one incident that night or five incidents or six incidents, they didn't understand, you know, why a person would do this. And by dwelling so much on all these other incidents, it led them to, you know, think about that, about the 6 month incidents and why would this person do this, instead of focusing on whether or not he intended to do damage to the vehicle and whether he intended to do $1,500 worth of damage. If I may, if there are no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Mr. Hanano.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Peter Hanano appearing on behalf of the State of Hawaii. So the question in this case is whether or not the ICA gravely erred in affirming the trial court's introduction of these prior acts into evidence in violation of 403. And so basically, you know, the standard here is one of reasonableness. And, you know, was the trial court unreasonable, and that's objectively unreasonable, in, you know, arriving at decision? So basically we're saying that, you know, it's not a situation where reasonable minds can differ. It's a situation where, you know, the decision that the trial court made was so out there that no reasonable jurist would have ruled in that manner.
And so, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. I thought we were evaluating this on an abuse of discretion standard.
Yes, and what the state is saying is that basically an abuse of discretion standard is basically that, you know, one of reasonableness, and that the court was not reasonable, objectively reasonable, in making that call, that judgment call.
What's the case site for that proposition?
I don't have that right now with me.
Thanks.
So the court in this case, in order to give context, Justice McKenna had suggested one route where perhaps the question could have just been, had you had prior unwanted contact with the defendant? Or had there been other situations where the... And instead of something like that to set it, the judge had four prior incidents, allow them to be described, inform the jury of six police reports that had been filed, allowed the the Normans to testify as to surveillance instruments and alarm systems and the number of cameras and their incredible fear. All of these things came in for context, which is not even a listed, enumerated factor under 404B.
Well, basically, the judge is trying to put, was allowing the state to put the whole situation, which includes the relationship between the parties, in context.
Well, you know, one of the things that the prosecutor said in explaining why the state wanted to do this, now, this is from his closing, now several precautions, he's talking about all the precautions they took. You heard they put in a surveillance system in. They put an alarm system in. They tinted their windows so this guy doesn't see into their house. We did put that evidence in to show you what their perception was of his state of mind. How is their perception of his state of mind relevant to this case?
Well, I think their perception, as far as, you know, what he did in the past, I think is relevant to show, you know, that they're in fear of this person.
That is what?
That they're in fear of the
defendant. But why is there fear? And I think that's, you just put your nail on the head, and that's perhaps what very well may have happened in this case. The Norman's fear of this individual is not an issue, it's not an element of criminal property damage.
That's correct.
So none of the evidence is relevant of their fear. And they testified how fearful they were and how...
Well, it is a criminal property damage case, and, you know, the prior incidents were admitted, and part of that was, you know, their perception of how they perceived the defendant coming through the house, you know, on those numerous occasions, and, you know, for whatever reason.
No. How is that relevant to the CPD?
Well,
the only issue is whether he intended to cause over $1,500 in damage.
I think it's part and parcel with allowing the prior incidents to come in, because then, I mean, it's almost like, you know, you got to provide some context for the prior incidents. I mean, you know, was it something that they did that, you know, may have upset the defendant?
Well, Mr. Hanano, can you just clarify, was there any reason to admit these prior incidents other than to show that the Normans were afraid of Mr. Gallagher?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why, the main reason it was admitted was to show the context of the relationship, and that, you know, the defendant had this animosity or ill will towards the Normans, And that is relevant to prove, you know, his intent as far as the extent of the damages that he intended to cause.
Let me ask you about that. I've been thinking and trying to figure that part of it out. Now, let's suppose the statutory amount in this case was $5,000. Would the evidence of the priors come in if the statutory amount was not $1,500 but $5,000?
I'll say yes.
What about $3,500?
Yes.
What about $1,000?
Yes.
What about $500?
Probably.
So in other words,
I think the more extensive the damage that you need to prove, I think the more probative the prior incidents such as this.
It sounds like that no matter what this, in other words, we're determining whether or not, even though there had been no prior incidents of damage, criminal property damage in any of the prior cases, there's a determination that we're going to let in these priors because somehow it helps to establish an amount which you've acknowledged could have been almost any number.
Well, not an amount, but to establish a state of mind with regard to what the defendant intended or knew as far as what the damage that was caused.
Well, it goes to his awareness, so it's
right. See, his state of mind.
Right, but it's difficult for me to see how that this damage amount that's set by statute somehow could be probative evidence sufficient to allow him all the stuff we just said to show that he had an awareness of this statutory amount of damage that he was causing.
So if this was a CPD-3, this would all still come in?
I would have to think about that. I mean, like I said, you know, the higher the amount, I think the more probative the prior incidents become, because you know you need to prove the extent of the damage, and that's what we need to prove.
Help me with this, Mr. Hinano. As Ms. Kagiwata has pointed out, there's pretty extensive video evidence of how angry he was. So what about these additional incidents would indicate that he was in a frame of mind different than what is demonstrated in the video?
Well, and you know, that's a question. I mean, and not only the state of mind, but you know, I think the trial judge also recognized that, you know, what was being represented by the defense was basically that there was only going to be one element at issue. But then, of course, you know, during the trial, that can change.
Well, let's accept your proposition that the element that's at issue that could potentially justify this is what the defendant intended the damage to be, how much damage, okay? So you have a video that shows him working really hard on this car, right? And not doing it in a way that's sort of exploratory to sort of check to see how the tires are, check to see how strong the car is. It seems pretty evident from the video that his intent is to do damage. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
So how does this additional evidence of the prior incidents go to the idea that what he's doing there is to create more damage than what's shown in the video?
Well, and that's the question is, you know,
let's say there are these prior incidents where he's harassing them.
Right, because it comes down to,
how do the prior incidents that he's harassing them somehow show that he's even more intent on creating more damage?
Well, I don't know about if you know, it came in to show that he was more intent to cause more damage than what was in the video, but it definitely is relevant to show what his intent was as far as what kind of extent.
Well, let's say, for example,
excuse me, I just followed. Didn't the judge give an instruction and tell the jury that they could look at the prior incidents on the issue of the defendant's preparation to commit the offense charge? Is preparation an issue in the case?
I think the judge gave the limiting instruction that was, I think, parallel to 404B, I believe. So he listed, basically whatever was in the statute, if I...
Well, I think normally when you give that instruction, you pick and choose amongst the bracket.
Okay.
And so what I'm asking for, because we have case law specifically on this, and preparation, we've held, is seldom an ultimate issue in a criminal case. Preparation comes in like somebody is going to, say, commit a robbery, and they steal a car in order to commit the robbery. That's preparation. You let that come in. How do those prior incidents have anything to do with preparation?
I guess it would show his intent to, because,
And the judge told him they consider that.
Right.
The same with plan. The judge told him they commit plan, and plan is not an element, and it's usually for conspiracy. That's what we said in Castro, and the same with identity. Identity really wasn't in dispute. I mean, the judge, so not only do these prior incidents come in, but the judge tells the jury they can utilize it for these things that aren't even an issue.
Well, that's the other thing, too, though. I mean, at that point when the judge made that decision, were they really not an issue? I mean, we heard arguments or statements in opening, but, the defendant could have changed his mind at any time and say, I'm not going to testify.
Okay,
now you guys got to prove everything. And so at the time when he did testify, only one issue became in dispute, and that was the issue that they represented earlier, but that could have changed. And that's what the judge recognized when he said, the state still has a duty to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, at that point in time, the prosecutor had said in opening statement something to the effect that they were 99%, I think that was the language the prosecutor utilized, regarding the case. Didn't he say something like that?
I'm not sure.
And I think if the argument is that any time, we rejected that in Castro. We didn't say that you could automatically assume that things wouldn't be an issue. And preparation plan would never be an issue in this case anyhow.
Well, it definitely goes to his intent to carry out the conduct.
Well,
because the other thing too is, we had, and going back to your question, Justice Wilson, about the video, the defense attorney stated, and this is the heart of it right here, the only thing really, this is in her opening statement, the only thing really in dispute is the damages. What was John thinking as far as the damages? What did he mean to do as far as the damages? What did he know? So that's why the prior incidents are
well, that's,
very probative.
That's a good point. I mean, there's a certain logic to the idea that if there is a question about what the value was that he had in mind when he committed the act, that you would want to have evidence that would suggest that maybe his purpose, because he was angry, to do damage. But if you, let's say, for example, if you had the video showing him creating damage with the car with a baseball bat, or he had a gun and he was shooting the car, I mean, is it really necessary for all these prior incidents to come in at that point? Perhaps we can agree at that point.
I would, it's pretty clear. I would agree in that situation that it's less likely you need anything. But the other point I wanted to make is if you look at the video, it's not that great. I mean, you got one car blocking the vision. Then he goes around the other side, and you can't see what's going on there. I mean, it looks like he's, assaulting the vehicle, but it's not 100% clear that what he's doing there.
But does
Mr. Gallagher simply testified that he lost his composure, right?
Right.
So that the video perhaps would support that?
I would say yes, it would. But then the question is, did he still intend to cause, the amount of damage that the state needed to prove?
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish, and especially finish if you're answering Justice Nakayama's question, please.
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention is, in closing, the defense attorney again says that the only thing in dispute concerns the damages, the extent of damages to the truck, what was going on in John's mind, did he mean to, or what was his conscious object to cause over $1,500 in damage, or did he know or believe that the damage would be that much? So, you know, that's why, again, the probative value of the prior acts is very high in relation to the prejudicial effect. And keep in mind that it has to be substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice, not just prejudice.
Are you arguing that, okay, so you're not, I'm before the harmless analysis, mm-hmm. in terms of 403, we have said that, you know, we unfair prejudice is a tendency to suggest a decision on an improper basis, commonly, though not necessarily, an emotional basis, right?
Yes.
Why did the state elicit so much evidence regarding the fear of the complaining witnesses? How was that not a completely emotional basis? Fear was not an element in this case.
Right. I understand what the court is seeing. Well, granted, you know, there was no prior argument about prosecutor misconduct. And that's what it sounds like we're headed. But
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you just said.
There was no prior assertion of prosecutorial misconduct, which what it kind of sounds like we're talking about now.
No, we're not talking about prosecutorial misconduct.
We're saying basically what the prosecutor said.
Well, the prosecutor went beyond just showing the incidents. The prosecutor put in evidence about tinting, alarms, fear. And so why isn't that evidence problematic?
Well, the thing is, okay, so the reason why the prior acts were admitted was to show the state of mind with respect to the defendant's knowledge of the damages or intent of the damages. And
the court said context.
Well, it's that, and to prove, you know, to show that, you know, like Justice Wilson said, if you're mad, it's more likely you're gonna come in more damage, you know, something to that effect, than just someone who just randomly goes by a car and starts beating on it.
Yeah, but I think what the Chief Justice just referred to is that it came with a lot of baggage. It came with a tremendous amount of incidental. In Kazanis, there was an opinion of this court which said, well, maybe one prior might have been okay. And I'm not suggesting one prior might have been okay, but it would certainly have been, or if it had been couched in different languages. But here, not only were there four priors, but there were six incidents of police reports. And the jury continued to hear escalating, you know.
And Mr. Hanano, let me ask you this. With regard to the matters I just mentioned, the tinting, alarms, fear, did the defense object to that?
I don't believe so.
And if not, is that problematic in terms of maintaining or preserving the record on that particular aspect of what took place?
Yes, it is problematic because, you know, the court could have corrected any type of misconduct or anything like that at the time, and because it wasn't, you know, then we're kind of stuck with looking back and trying to figure out, you know, whether there's plain error, I guess.
Do you think it was enough that the court gave defense counsel a running objection on 404? Is that enough to preserve it, or is that, does counsel have an obligation to, when something comes in beyond, because the proffer was the prior, so something comes in beyond the priors, does counsel have an obligation to object at that point, or is that subsumed within the running objection?
I think counsel has a duty to object because it's like I said, I mean, now we're kind of, seems like we're going down prosecutorial misconduct based on, you know, comments or statements. And the other thing too is, you know, we're talking about all this evidence that came in and whether it was used, you know, the jury utilized it for an improper purpose. And that's really the question, because the sole issue in this case was the defendant's state of mind with regard to the damages. All the other stuff he conceded. So therefore, because with 404B, the danger typically is, you know, you're going to bring in these priors to show that the person acted in conformity therewith. In other words, he did it before, he must have did it this time. We don't have that here because it wasn't a criminal property damage that came in as far as the priors. So that's gone. The other thing is, you know, they're going to hear all this evidence, prior bad acts about the defendant, and they're going to use that and say, you know what, there's no evidence that we can find of his intent to cause the 1500, but we think he's a bad guy because he did these prior offenses, and therefore we're going to find him guilty. I think that's the heart of the issue here, is whether the jury did that. Did they use that evidence for an improper purpose?
Do you think that the questions that were asked by the jury that had to do with the restraining order and his mental health history, and well, you think that would indicate that perhaps they were making a decision based on issues that weren't necessarily focused on the value of the damage?
Well, it definitely goes into the mind of the juror and tells you what they're thinking. However, not all of the questions were asked, and questions that were asked were before the court gave the final jury instructions that, you know, you need to focus on the evidence and just the evidence. And you can use this prior acts only, again, like they did before, only for these certain situations.
Yeah, but the one problem is the situations that the judge told them were not correct.
Arguably, I mean.
There's no objection to the jury instruction, was there?
No. Not on that one, anyway.
Are you aware of any cases that say a jury instruction that simply tracks Rule 404B is improper because it doesn't parse out the specific grounds the court relied on?
No, I'm not aware of any. But then again, you know, it goes back to whether the jury utilized this information for an improper purpose. So that would mean that the jury would have to disregard all of the court's instructions, disregard the fact that the reason it was coming in was to prove the state of mind with regard to the damages, and then find that because he's a bad guy, he must have intended to commit over $1,500 in damages. I think that's the ultimate question that it comes down to. And if you look at, you know, the
court. Isn't that our, I mean, it would appear that the whole reason, and we have a very strong history of application of Rule 404. I mean, if you look back at the origin of 404, the whole purpose of it is that prior misconduct is such a heavy, significant factor on any juror's appraisal of evidence that we take extra precautions. And in this jurisdiction, we take strong precautions. And in this case, not only do we have four incidents of significant detail, six police, and I've mentioned, we have all kinds of other things. And what you're asking us to do is, despite 404, despite the requirement of 403, which has a significant weighing of probativeness versus prejudicial effect, is to essentially say, well, the jury, despite all their questions and everything else, the jury disregarded all of this. That's a pretty significant, and we have to conclude that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, again, it goes back to, did the court abuse this question? In allowing it, you know, so it's not a right or wrong standard, it's abuse of discretion. And basically what the court was faced at the time was, you know, not only, you know, the court wasn't sure at the time that the defendant was going to actually concede everything else.
I found that quote incidentally that I was trying to, and this, the court gave that instruction because after it was the objection, there was an objection before the evidence in motion limine, and then right after Mrs. Norman got up to testify, there was an objection from the defense, and the court then gave that jury instruction. But already in opening, this is what the state said. It anticipated the jury was, quote, what you're probably going to hear the defense agree with pretty much 99% of what I have just told you. And that very story is going to tell you with only a slight twist. So they already knew exactly what was, the state had already said, the defense had already indicated, and they knew exactly what the evidence was going to come out.
Well, that was what they right. I mean, at the time, right?
Because there was a video.
There's a video. And on the video, you know, there were questions from the jurors that were asking, is it clear, can you really see it? I mean, so, you know, let's not put too much weight on the video, because there were questions from the jury that was questioning the clarity and whether or not
you there could were photographs see. Too.
Right, but photographs of the car, I believe, not and the there weren't two videos, there were one video. There was one video. It was just a video of a close-up of that particular screen or camera.
Mr. Hanano, maybe you can help me with the harmless error analysis, because I think your position is that these six incidents were necessary. They're important, correct?
Yes.
To the proof
right.
of the government's case. And certainly these incidents appeared to have had an effect on the jury because of the questions that were asked, right?
Well, in effect,
I mean, the jury's asking.
I mean, I'm not going to come out and say that they improperly decided the case based on the prior acts. I mean, because that's what the whole.
But I'm just suggesting that the questions that have to do with the mental health history and the prior right. incidents would yes. suggest that maybe they were thinking about those six incidents, correct?
Yes.
So, assuming that it was error in the balancing under 403, given the fact that this is considered to have been important evidence, probative, that's the reason the court let it in. If it was error to let it in, would it logically follow then that you can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury didn't consider that evidence in reaching its verdict?
I would have to disagree with that, because
so you think that you can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury really didn't consider all these incidents?
Well, not didn't consider, but didn't.
Well, isn't that the test? I mean, the test is you have to be able to say,
right,
beyond a reasonable doubt, from the point of view, you know, of a reasonable jury, you have to say beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury's verdict wasn't affected by the error that was made or the evidence that was improperly admitted. And is that your conclusion?
My conclusion is that it didn't affect, what I'm saying is they didn't use it to say the guy is a bad guy and therefore we're going to convict him on, you know.
Okay, but what if they used it improperly, or they used it to reach their determination on any issue that led to the verdict?
Then I think
if it was inadmissible, it was error to admit it, and the jury relied upon it to reach their verdict. Let's assume they didn't rely upon it to find he was a bad guy. They just relied upon it to decide that he committed over $1,500 worth of damage. Wouldn't that mean that the error was not harmless?
Yes. I mean, that was the whole reason why it was admitted. So when you ask it that way, then I have to say yes.
Hmm. Thank you.
Very well. Anything further to wrap up at this point?
I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hanano. Ms. Kagiwara.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to clarify the record, this issue first came up in a motions in limine hearing, and it was discussed at length about 2 weeks before trial, and the court at that time ruled that, to provide context, the court was going to let these incidents in, all four of them. And then when trial started, I've heard a couple of things from the prosecutor, so I just want to clarify. At opening statement, defense counsel said the sole issue is going to be whether or not Mr. Gallagher intended to do $1,500 worth of damage. Following the opening statements, that's when Ms. Norman was called to testify again, and defense counsel again renewed her objections. There was a lengthy discussion as to whether or not these four priors would be admitted. And at the end of that, defense counsel said, may I please make a running objection? And the court said yes.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Hanano. Is that enough to preserve an objection with regard to tinting, alarms, fear, impact on the Normans?
Well, once the priors were admitted, you know, then the prosecutor was free to ask about those priors, and those were the kinds of responses that came in.
Well, the question is, that necessarily follow? In other words, the as I understood it, prosecutor said, we need to get evidence of these prior events in. Court said, yes. And then as the evidence unfolded, there were questions about, you know, what did you folks do? What was your response? And there was no objection on those particular points. And my question is, was defense counsel obligated to preserve the record, object to that, in essence, what seems to be, and perhaps you wouldn't agree with this, going beyond simply describing the incidents to what they did in response or how they felt about it?
Yeah, well, and I would disagree with the prosecutor's point, but, you know, she already brought it up twice, saying she objected for various reasons, and the court said these are coming in. So I don't know what else she could have done. Also, it would have drawn more attention to the incidents if she kept objecting to, you know, the way the evidence was coming in.
Well, wouldn't the objection be this goes beyond the offer of proof of prior incidents but goes into irrelevant matters of whether she's was afraid? Or that's a different objection, isn't it?
I could see that that would be a different objection. But again, I believe the court already kind of indicated its position. And again, this is the problem with the priors coming in at all, you know, these four priors coming in, because it is going to elicit this kind of response. It is going to talk about the fear and the escalating nature of these events and the terror that the Normans felt. I would like to amend my prior position in answer to a question regarding whether or not nothing should have come in. I believe that's for, if this case is remanded, I believe that's for the circuit court on remand. And I understand that, you know, the point being that there was some need to show context. Again, I think it went far overboard. There was way too much. And it became about the terror and the escalating events and the six-month odyssey that the Normans had to endure.
If we were to rule that, you know, the defense counsel had an obligation to reassert additional objections after the court had ruled twice that these incidents could come into evidence, would we then be facing a Rule 40 for ineffective assistance for not raising those additional objections?
Possibly. I mean, if that's the way that the court rules, then I believe that would be the next step. But again, you know, I think the court was pretty clear that these incidents were coming in.
So I'm reading the questioning. After describing some of the incidents, the prosecutor goes, okay, did you and your husband do anything to your house as a result of the defendant's actions?
Mm-hmm.
No objection. So why not object? That's beyond the proffer. It's got doesn't appear to have anything to do with establishing the incidents. Now you're talking about response. Why isn't that fairly beyond the scope of the running objection?
Possibly it is. Possibly it is something that the defense counsel should have objected to. You know, but again, I think the defense counsel got a clear message from the court that this evidence was coming in. And, you know, if you start parsing through what exactly is coming in, you know, it's difficult. You know, you are drawing attention to these incidents more so than maybe the defense wanted it to. And just to be clear, we are not arguing prosecutorial misconduct, because I believe once the evidence was omitted, the prosecutor was arguing from the evidence. So we can't really fault the prosecutor from relying upon the evidence once it came in. That's the problem with the omission in the first place, especially in this case where there was unfair prejudice that substantially outweighed minimal probative value. And I think that's what I'd like to conclude with, is the value of all these incidents was minimal compared to the videos and other evidence, and it far outweighed the probative value. And it clearly was not harmless, given the jury's response and the questions that they asked. Are there any more questions from the court?
Well, nothing further from the court.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise.